My name is Chelsea Clifford. I am 30 years old. Today is December 1st, 2019, and I'm speaking with Mary Louise Clifford, who is my grandmother. We are recording this interview in Alexandria, Virginia. Okay, we did that. Sorry, it's not putting these in the order I was expecting. Just ignore these and just go for it. Yep, I think I'll do that. Okay. How about to start? Can you tell me about when you met Grandpa? Tell me that story.
I was working in Beirut, and I was the administrative assistant to the petroleum attaché. And Bob, my husband, later husband, came to Beirut to be the commercial attaché. And we were on the same floor in the legation. And Bob liked to explore. So weekends he would drive around the country and took me, usually. And we explored all of Lebanon and a lot of Syria and some of Jordan. We went to Jerusalem. And we were married in Beirut at the St. George Cathedral on the waterfront because we wanted to travel together through Europe on our way home. And Bob was old-fashioned enough that he didn't think we could do that unless we were married.
Wow. I always did wonder why you guys went ahead and got married there. Do you remember the first time you saw him or you met him? How did you guys end up on this trip?
I was at a cocktail party at Dick Sanger's, and Bob came in halfway through the party, and we were introduced, and then we all went from the Sanger's house down to the St. George Club to dance. And that was the first time that I met him.
What did you think about him then?
I thought he was very handsome. I have a weakness for tall men with dark hair, and he fit the bill perfectly.
Got to have standards. Who came to your wedding?
All the people in the legation and the military attaché's office and the people who were stationed in Beirut with the oil companies. Beirut in those days was small enough that you could know everybody. And so all of the friends that Bob and I had made were at the wedding. It was on the roof of the St. George Club, lovely sunny day, very pretty reception.
Was it odd not to have your family there for your wedding, or were you happy to have this adventure separately?
My family didn't approve of me marrying Bob because he'd been divorced. And so I figured, and they also, my mother was a teetotaler. She'd taken the pledge when she was a young woman and was still abiding by it. She gave it up eventually. But I knew that if they were at my reception, it would put a damper on it. So I was glad to be able to have my wedding and the reception just the way I wanted it.
I guess that's the bridal dream today. I don't know about back then. What kind of person would they have wanted you to marry?
Well, they wouldn't have approved of us serving drinks. And their disapproval would have shown. So I didn't want that. My mother had come out to Beirut about 3 months previously, bringing my younger brother, to try to talk me out of marrying Bob. And so I had shown them a week of sightseeing. I took them to Jerusalem and did everything that I could think of that would entertain them. And then they were going to fly back, but I talked them into taking one of the combination commercial and resort ships back to New York, because it would have been a very pleasant experience. So they'd been there, and they'd done their best to talk me out of it. That was enough of that.
Yeah, we're all very stubborn, as we discussed. Had they actually met Grandpa at that point, or was it just sort of his reputation that they didn't like?
It was the idea that I was marrying someone who was divorced and had a couple of children by his first wife. They were rigid. I grew up in a household where everything had to be very proper. And you had to be very careful what the neighbors thought. And it was a very limiting environment, and one that both my sister and I rebelled against. Mother had met Bob because she'd come out to Beirut. I don't think she ever was reconciled to having him as a son-in-law, but she was polite to him. And my father found him very interesting because Bob would take him off somewhere. Let's go to Niagara Falls, or, you know. And they would have a wonderful talk. They were able to converse extensively and with great enjoyment. And so he always took my father off someplace to get him away from Mother, who wanted to be in charge of everything. So I think my father was reconciled to him. I think he liked him very much. Mother never was, although she was civil. But after the first three or four times that we went up to the farm to visit, I didn't take him with me any longer. I took the children instead. And of course, my mother loved small children.
Well, so I guess at least she got that out of that marriage, even if she didn't entirely come around.
Well, the interesting thing is that when she moved to the convent, she started drinking wine, because that's what the girls had. The nuns had with their dinner, so she had some. And she apparently, while she was living with them, changed a lot of her attitudes.
Do you know what it was that persuaded her that it was okay to drink wine at that point?
If these nuns were drinking wine, what could be wrong with it?
So she really respected the moral character of the nuns.
I think that was it, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, who could be more, who could have higher moral standards than a whole sisterhood of nuns?
Well, I thought she didn't approve of Catholicism at first when your sister...
She didn't. That was terrible, terrible trial to her. But they took care of her for 12 years. And she had a beautiful place to live, and they came and fed her if she didn't want to eat and made a big fuss over her. And she eventually joined the Catholic Church. I guess she thought she was there living with them. she'd just go along with it.
Yeah, that's quite a change late in life.
Well, I'll say.
So you say both you and your sister rebelled, but you took pretty different paths. Why do you think that happened?
Well, my sister joined the Navy and was assigned to the hospital in Boston that received all the wounded sailors. And it must have been pretty grim. And she had a friend in her unit of the Navy who was a Catholic and who went to this center in Cambridge called the St. Benedict Center and took her with her one night. And she liked the atmosphere, and they talked her into joining the group at the St. Benedict Center. I've thought about this a lot over the course of my lifetime, because I didn't see her for 30 years. But we talked when we finally restored our sisterly relationship. We talked about being hyper, and I said something about being hyper. And she said, "Oh, don't tell me about hyper." And I said, "Well, how do you deal with it?" And she said, "Prayer and meditation." So that was finally an explanation of how she dealt with her demons, which I could accept. We inherited an anxiety complex, both of us, from our, I guess it was my mother, because my grandfather had what was known as a nervous breakdown, which nobody talked about except in whispers. But the anxiety was there, and I relied on medication, and she relied on prayer.
Yeah, I'm familiar with these issues, and also the silence around it in my youth, although I imagine it was less severe then. But you know that Jordan, my brother, recently has taken up going to church, and he's finding it calming. And I told him, you had mentioned that bit about why Great Aunt Ellen, the relief she found in the religious experience, and I told him about it, and I don't know, he seemed to be pondering it. We'll see where this goes. It's kind of associated with the latest girlfriend, so we'll see how long that...
Does he have another girlfriend?
He has one with the same name as him for most of the last year, yes.
The same?
Name.
Not Jen.
No, they're both named Jordan now, to be confusing. The girlfriend's name is Jordan, as well as...
Going out with Jordan.
Right, exactly. I met her last night. She seems competent. I don't know. But I guess I should get back on topic. Why do you think... You were still brought up to be religious, but Protestant, right?
Mm. We grew up in the Baptist church. My sister was baptized, which is not done in the Baptist church until you're 12 or 13 years old, because it's a choice. Ellen and I never joined the Baptist church. It was our social life. We went to church on Sunday. Sunday night I went to young people's. Wednesday night there was a potluck supper. Thursday night there was choir practice, probably something else on Friday. That was our main social life. I sang in the choir from the beginning of my high school years. I played the organ in the church when the organist was away. And I went to Young People's faithfully every week. But as I, are you sure the Library of Congress is interested in this?
We'll see. I've heard stranger things on there.
Okay. When I thought back on it in my later years, wondering why I was so against the Baptist Church, I remembered that the first Sunday school I went to, we had an elderly gray-haired woman named Grace, a very sweet, gentlewoman, and she taught us to sing Jesus Loves Me and all this. The next teacher I had across the hall when I was a little older was one of these God is right behind your shoulder watching everything you do, and if you don't do what you're supposed to do, he'll zap you. And if you behave yourself, you can go to heaven. And I can see her now with her little black sausage curls telling us what our future consisted of. And I must have realized at the time that she really couldn't promise that. Or I may have realized it much later. But I just, that rabid Old Testament God and the gentle New Testament God, it just didn't make sense to me. And this is, I suppose, why I never joined. I went and did everything I was supposed to. But once I went to college, I was no longer bothered.
And your sister reconciled these multiple versions, because she must have gotten yet another from the Catholic Church somehow.
Well, I don't think that she carried on her Baptist. She went to Cornell and finished in 3 years and then did social work locally and found that it was exhausting because she couldn't leave her cases behind when she got home. So she went and joined the Navy. Her career track was very different from mine. I'd gotten my degree from Cornell and I won a national scholarship to go to Katie Gibbs for a year and was recruited in the spring of that year by the CIA. And went to Washington in June of the year that I finished Katie Gibbs. And I knew that I was going to go overseas. And I did 3 or 4 months training in Washington, the most important part of which was learning the one-time code, the unbreakable code. And as soon as you learned it, well, you were ready to go. I did study, I did have some instruction in camera work and in lock picking. And that stood me in good stead because one day, Doc, my boss, the petroleum attaché, changed the combination to the file that we kept locked that had the top secret documents in it. And he wrote it on a paper and he gave it to me and he said, here. So I put it in the file drawer and locked it up. And the next morning he couldn't remember the combination. So here we were with all of our important papers locked. So when I'd finished my work for the morning, I took a chair over by the file drawer, cabinet, and started. Well, first I worked out what numbers Doc would and wouldn't have used, because of the numbers that he'd used before. And then I wrote down multiple combinations of the remaining numbers that I thought he would have used. And I simply dialed them until I heard it click. And there we were. I had opened the locked file cabinet without knowing enough. I could hear it. You could hear the tumblers. And it took me about half an hour.
That's pretty good. How many numbers would it have been? I'm trying to think how many combinations there could have.
6 or 7.
Jeez, that's a lot.
Maybe 8.
You told me that you had used your lock-picking skills that you'd learned to unlock file cabinets and it had come in useful later, but somehow I thought that was sometime more recently, not back then.
That was while I was working in Beirut.
Wow.
No, you know, you have a little instruction in this kind of thing, and you learn how to feel a lock when you're... And you learn, you can hear what a lock is doing. If I hadn't had the instruction, I wouldn't have had any idea how to do it. But they did teach us to pick locks and to photograph documents and that kind of thing. We were supposed to be useful. We also were very beautifully trained Katie Gibbs secretaries. And I could take dictation at 130 words a minute, and I never used it.
Which took longer to learn?
Well, taking dictation at 130 words a minute is that takes a whole year of learning shorthand and how to. Punctuate sentences and the whole business of being able to take dictation. And I was at the top of the skill when I was recruited, and that was one of the things that they were impressed by.
But they didn't actually want you to use it?
My boss never dictated.
So what did you do all day then? And I mean, I get that there are other things that secretaries do, but like, what were your days like?
Well, I coded and decoded all of the correspondence that went back and forth to Washington, and then we wrote reports on the material that we got in from our various contacts, and I typed those. Some of them came in French, in a little bitty teeny pieces of airmail paper. One of the reasons I was sent to Beirut was because I knew French. And when I was asked, you were given 3 choices. And when I was filling out that form, I didn't list 3 choices. I said, I want to go somewhere, not France, where I can use my French. That's why I was sent to Beirut.
Do you remember what your other, or was it 3 criteria, or like they gave you 3 countries?
3 places.
Do you remember what the others were?
I didn't ask for any others. I just said I wanted to go not to France, but someplace I could use my French. So that would either be Beirut or Vietnam or, you know, former French colonies.
That seems like quite a transition from New York or even D.C., which must have been quite a transition from Cornell and then from the farm before that.
Yes. I was young and vigorous and full of beans. And I enjoyed very much what I did in those years. It was a very... positive experience. I enjoyed my work. I enjoyed my boss. I liked his family. I used to babysit for his children. Excuse me. And I loved the traveling around the countryside with Bob, who with whom I fell in love very quickly. He loved to explore, and that was one of the things that I really enjoyed about being married to him, is that when we were overseas, there wasn't anything that was too much trouble. He was going to do it. And he took me along. I could tell some horrendous tales about some of those trips, but it was a very positive experience.
It's pretty amazing. Sounds like some kind of novel, but I imagine living it was rather different.
I felt very fortunate that I was sent to such a good post. My friend Nancy was sent to Tehran, and she came to Beirut a couple of times to see doctors. And Tehran was not a good experience, apparently. But Beirut was. The people in the legation were very friendly. And as I said earlier, you could know everybody in town, and Bob did. And I was always entertained when we would go out nightclubbing. We'd run into people that I knew were on our payroll, like the head of the Surete, or, you know. And it would just amuse me to think that here I was, this little American girl, meeting all these exotic people. At least they seemed exotic at the time. The interesting thing is that we were keeping track of what the communists were doing and what everybody else was doing in the Middle East. And I still see the names of the descendants of the people we were sending in reports about. They're in the news. They have been throughout my life. This is one of the reasons that I read The Economist so carefully, because I keep finding names that are familiar to me.
So were these people local to Beirut, or were these people from other governments that were also there?
These were local Arabs who were heads of organizations. The head of the Druze was on our payroll, and I see his son is now head of the Druze, and they've been having some trouble with where they live up in the mountains, and I can't quite remember what it was, but I knew who this man was. We had gone up to his father's house and had tea. Because I was dating your father, and he took me along everywhere, I met a lot of people I wouldn't have met otherwise, because he and his work was meeting all these people. So I never told him that some of them were on our roster of informants.
So there were secrets you kept from your job to the end.
One was supposed to. One wasn't supposed to talk about any of this. I mean, we took an oath that we would be silent. I have a book that I'd like to tell you about. It's about the Armenians at the time. The Turks were trying to do away with them. And an Armenian village climbed up into a mountain, Musa Dag, and held out for 40 days against the Turks, who were attacking them from down below, until they were rescued by an American ship offshore. And this is written by a famous writer of the time, but it's about this young man who led this siege. And I have the book signed by that man when he was our informant. How many years later would that have been? 40 years later? And he's the one who wrote in French on these little tiny pieces of oilskin paper. And I had to translate what he wrote. But I have that book, and I would like somehow or other to have you or whoever be aware of the significance of it. And I've put a sheet of paper in it saying that the signature is of the man who led the siege. Isn't that fun?
Yes, that's really quite something. I should definitely read that. So you were able to keep up with some of these people from your work, the early days of it, through the decades, or would they crop up here and there? Or?
I would see these names that we had written reports on. Mm-hmm. And then I would see the sons who would move into their father's position. There was a communist in Damascus that we kept very close tabs on. I think his name was George Haddad. He led the Communist Party in that part of the world. And his son followed him. And I see those names when I'm reading The Economist. Not so much now, but in earlier years. They were important then, and the families are still important. They're the prominent politicians of that part of the world.
So when you read the names of these sons later, was the issue still communism, or what has it transformed to?
Well, George Haddad was still, and his son, were active in communist affairs. The head of the Druze, I guess he was one of our informants, I'm not sure. But we took a busload on a tour up there. It was before Bob came to Beirut. And all sat around the edges of his huge receiving room and were given tea. And the thing that was the most fun about that experience was that we had to go to the bathroom, and we had no idea what we would find. And it turned out to be a little hut that was built over a steep gorge with water running down it. And when you looked down the holes, there was the running water.
Well, not great for water quality, but at least it was obvious where to go, so you weren't going to commit some kind of...
You
mean you going... that the bathroom was over water? Yeah. I saw some worse things in Madagascar, absolutely. I think that's how I got that lymph node infection. People just going kind of wherever. Not so good. That would be not so good for the people downstream.
And Samoa, the villages would have a little hut over the water.
I guess that's privacy, at least. So what is it like to have gone through these experiences and done this work and attempted to nudge U.S. foreign policy and policy of other governments in various directions, and then to see the same names later, what does it feel like you guys changed or didn't change, or how does that feel?
Well, it just made sense that they were in positions that things occurred that the newspapers picked up. A lot depended on who was reporting from that part of the world. But Camille Jumblatt, who was head of the Druze, was an important figure in Lebanon. The Druze is a minority sect, but very much there. And when you read about the difficulty in forming governments in Lebanon since the Troubles, all of these people have to be taken into account because the Druze are a minority sect in Lebanon. So anything that's happening when they're trying to put together a government and the Druze are involved, you hear the same name. It's Jumblatt. And at the time that Lebanon was having such difficulty damping down the civil war, and they have a very complicated form of government because the president is a Christian and the prime minister is an Arab, and they switch that around when they have a new election. And all of the other important people in government represent the various tribal units in the country. And even now, they have a prime minister named Hariri, and he had a very good reputation, but he's having difficulty now with the Hezbollah, the Iranian group that's so prominent in Lebanon. So this all is part of what was going on when we were there.
Are there lessons that you learned then? I know there are lessons you learned then, but are there particular things, you know, bullet points that you could condense down for, you know, we have a government that kind of likes bullet points right now, for, you know, what should people know that you learned then for how we're behaving now?
Well, the most prominent problem that most of the governments have is their election system. They have proportional representation, and so you'll get some Druze, and when you come to form a government like that, Israel has had this problem from the very beginning, and they have it right now because nobody there, they've done three elections this year, and nobody there can form a government because they can't gather enough representation from the other parties. This was going on when we were there. Nothing's changed. Proportional representation may seem a fairer way than having only two candidates and
winner takes all.
Winner take all. But it you don't get these crises where they don't have a government for, Israel hasn't had a government for, 5 months at least? And Syria is the same thing. And finally, you ended up having a dictator, a military man, overthrow the civilian government. And that's what you've got in Syria still. You've got his son. Jordan has had a monarch because, you have to know the history of the area too, because when the British and the French divided the Middle East up after the First World War, they put two royal princes into Iraq and Jordan. The Iraqi prince was overthrown by the military, and you ended up with Saddam Hussein. Jordan has still got its king, who is descended from the prophet, and all of the other Arab countries help Jordan because they don't want something to happen to King Abdullah, because he is a firm point of power that they can trust. And so Jordan is swamped with the refugees. The Palestinians, of course, half its population is Palestinian. And the Israelis, of course, say that Jordan is really is Palestine, and all the Palestinians should go there and live. But this started when we were in Beirut. They were under tents in refugee camps all over Lebanon. And some of the camps have been permanent. They've built buildings to live in. But they're still in camps. They're still determined they're going back.
And that would be next generation or generation after that now.
Yeah.
So what is that, and having known people all over the world and lived through some of the horrors that went with World War II, what does that make you think of our country's current asylum, refugee, immigration kind of situation?
Well, immigration is a
complex issue.
An issue that most people don't understand. Everywhere we've lived, people had wanted to go to America. But on the other hand, we've also met people who thought what we were doing in our foreign policy was wrong. That particularly in Black Africa. Right now, we don't have a foreign policy. And it's grievous because we're losing the respect of all of our friends around the world. And nobody knows whether they can count on us or not. Terrible situation. I understand why people want to come to this country. We're enormously rich. You've seen poverty. Until you've seen poverty, you don't know what it is. And we're rich, there's no question about it. There's nothing surprising about people wanting to come to this country because they can live better than they have or wherever they came from. I think we have to control immigration. And presumably we have laws that do control it if people follow the proper procedures. Having hundreds of people sneak across our southern border, however, is against the law.
Yeah.
When the law breaks down, everything else breaks down. I don't know whether that answers your question.
Oh, I don't think there is an easy answer. So you had to give up the job you had to marry Grandpa, right?
Right. We were not allowed to be married then. About 10 or 15 years later, the law was changed and women were permitted to work in the Foreign Service. By then I had children. I could have gone back to Washington and been reinstated. But your grandfather wouldn't have liked that.
Do you wish that you'd stayed more engaged in the way you were with foreign policy and such, or was your ongoing involvement by moving around with Grandpa and the books you wrote enough?
That's a hard question.
Yeah.
I love the fact that we traveled, and wherever we were stationed, we went out and explored the whole country. in Pakistan, we drove through the northwest frontier up in the area